Welcome to Health Media Now with award-winning author and host Denise Messenger for a lifetime of health empowerment. Live by being in the pink, meaning P stands for being persistent, I stands for using your intuition, N stands for networking, and K stands for obtaining knowledge. Preserve and protect your health by listening live every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our guests entertain and share cutting-edge information. They share with you what may have taken years to achieve through experience in their field. Become inspired and motivated. Reach your full potential with fascinating tips and products. Receive a lifetime of benefits from authors, doctors, practitioners, healthcare providers, and learn about exciting new products. You asked for it, and we deliver. Now, here's your host, Denise Messenger.
Hello, listeners. Today is July 2nd, 2014. I'm so glad that you've tuned in with us today because we have a fantastic guest. Our guest today is John Arden, PhD. He currently is the Director of Training in Mental Health for Kaiser Permanente, located in Northern California. He oversees training in 24 medical centers, where over 130 postdoctoral residents and interns are trained each year. He has also authored and co-authored 13 books, and the book that we're going to be talking about today is his latest, and it is called The Brain Bible. I'd like to now take the opportunity to welcome Dr. Arden to our show. Hello, Dr. Arden. Hello, Dr. Arden.
Hi, it's great to be here. Can you hear me?
I like to start my shows out by asking my guests how they got on the path that they're on today.
Well, I actually started in the mental health field, roughly about 40 years ago. And worked in a number of different capacities. I was very much part of the deinstitutionalization movement and worked in San Francisco, setting up alternatives to inpatient care, and then branched out, worked with a number of different ethnic groups like Native Americans in the Southwest and Latinos in the Southwest and people in the inner cities and other areas, and then have been working in Kaiser Permanente for the last 25 years in a number of capacities.
You must like it.
Oh, yeah. I'm very excited about integrated care, that a psychologist could talk to the podiatrist, that we're talking about the whole body here. We're not talking about dividing it up and not sharing information. Rather, we're sharing information, and it's about integrated care, which is the wave of the future. So I'm very happy about that.
Fabulous. We know there's an estimated 76.1 million American baby boomers that are going to be transitioning into their senior years. So the book that you've just come out with, The Brain Bible, is very timely. You want to talk to us about this?
Sure. I'm one of the 76 million that you're talking about. And I have been very interested in what are the major factors that research can support that those of us that want to keep our brains healthy ought to be practicing on a regular basis. And let's face it, there's a lot of terrible misinformation out there. Every time you turn around, there's another fad about the latest kind of berry you might eat, or maybe use this supplement, or do this particular exercise. at the exclusion of everything else, and then the next week that we find out that it really didn't work so well because the research wasn't very robust. So what I wanted to do was to take a look at the research in its entirety and take a look at consistent research. What have we accumulated over time that has been duplicated in multiple studies, and what can we offer people out there that don't want to sift through a lot of research? And so what I found was that there were five factors that seemed to be very strongly supported by the research literature, and I put them in a mnemonic called SEEDS. If you plant seeds now, you can reap really great benefit, reap great fruit for the rest of your life. In other words, you'll be happier, less depressed, less anxious, and get dementia symptoms later than you would have had you not followed this plan.
And SEEDS stands for something.
Yes,
in your book.
Exactly. So let's go over them one at a time. To begin with, the first S is social connectedness. Let's face it, we are an incredibly social creature. We survived from an evolutionary perspective by working together. In fact, we're the species that is born most premature. We spend the greatest length of time with our principal caregivers than any other species. You know, some species are, you know, hatched or born and a couple, maybe a week, they're out of the nest and they're gone. Now, in our society, we have kids that are in their late 20s and haven't left the nest, so to speak. But from an actual brain perspective, the brain isn't actually mature until the mid-20s anyway. So the interaction that we have with our principal caregivers and those around us really sculpt the brain, really form the brain as to what it is. And it turns out that people that are more depressed tend to be lonelier. Or let me reverse it. People that are lonely late in life get more depressed more easily, they get more anxious more easily, and they get dementia symptoms earlier. Even down to the chromosomal level, we see deficits related to social deprivation. So the caps on the ends of the chromosomes, which are called telomeres, actually shrink. They shrink with loneliness. So what you're talking about here in terms of a broad stroke is that loneliness actually accelerates aging. So the second factor. Exercise is the first E, and it is probably the most powerful thing that you can do for your brain. So harking back to our evolutionary past, you could say that largely most of us, our species, existed in a hunter-gatherer type of format whereby we moved about 10 miles a day until the advent of agriculture. And 10 miles a day is a lot of movement. And I don't know many people that move 10 miles a day unless they're sitting in a car. And so exercise is actually a term that was recently invented because people were moved quite a bit, even 100 years ago. So exercise is a powerful biological necessity. And what I'm talking about with respect to exercise is aerobic exercise. You've got to get your heart pumping. You've got to sweat a little bit, and you've got to do it at least 30 minutes a day. And the benefits of exercise are profound. I mean, even down to the growth of new neurons, which is called neurogenesis, that occurs in specific and very important areas of your brain, like the hippocampus, laying down new memories. So exercise is a powerful brain tonic. You can call it the stimulator of Miracle-Gro, which is a substance called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. So exercise, second E, or first E, rather. The second E is education. Shall I go on through all these, Diane?
Oh, sure. I just wanted to ask you, when you were talking about the brain, with exercise, does that contribute to actually helping to rewire the mature brain?
Yes. Now, the substance that I was talking about, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, it's one of many, actually, helps with the process known technically as neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is easier to remember if you use the word rewire your brain. In fact, my prior book was called Rewire Your Brain, because most people aren't going to remember the long mouthful term neuroplasticity. So yes, exercise is a wonderful way to create the conditions in your brain to help it rewire. And rewiring essentially is the development of new connections between the neurons. And the second E, in fact, promotes connectivity. So the more you learn, especially throughout your life and especially later in life, the more connectivity you have between your neurons. So let's pause for a second and take a broad look at the brain. Your brain, my brain, has roughly 100 billion neurons, and each neuron has roughly about 10,000 connections between the neurons. And those connections increase as we develop greater and greater cognitive capacities. In other words, the more education you have, the more connections you make, and we call that cognitive reserve. So later in life, you can lose more cells without looking like you lost much. In other words, you have more to lose without looking like you lost much. Do you follow what I mean? So you have a bigger bench to work with. And there have been multiple studies that have demonstrated that, in fact, people that have greater degrees of education, and I don't mean having a lot of fancy degrees and all that, but just challenging your brain to learn more late in life helps you withstand and also prevent some loss. So what you're doing is you're growing your brain by making new connections. So education is a profound requirement for the longevity of your brain.
Would brain exercises also? Well, would brain exercises also be helpful?
Oh, absolutely. Education is brain exercises. So if you play games, certainly, you know, let's say playing chess, which is probably the most robust brain-building game that we have, because not only you're looking at details, but you're also looking at the broad scope of the board. So every time you move a pawn, you're actually looking at how that pawn movement changes the entire configuration of the board, and then you're trying to judge what your opponent might be planning. So not only are you moving your pieces, but you're trying to judge what he or she might be planning to do. So that kind of game, major benefit for brain building. Now, you might ask crossword puzzles and different things like that. Sure, all those things are good, but think in terms of this. When you go to a gym, if you exercise just your biceps, you're going to grow big biceps, but you're not going to grow new muscle tissue all over your body because you're just exercising your biceps. So the games that you play have a larger benefit to you if you incorporate more brain-building skills or cognitive skills.
Okay. Learning a foreign language would be a good example.
Oh, absolutely. And learning an instrument as well. Learning a language has been shown to increase specific areas of the brain that are involved in the acquisition of a language, and same with learning an instrument. So there have been multiple studies that have shown that people that exercise their brain through education, and you could say language acquisition and learning an instrument is exercising your brain, builds neural tissue, connectivity in those areas that correspond to those skills.
I have a good question for you, and I'm sure our listeners are probably curious because a lot of our listeners have children. Mathematics is a challenge for some children as well as for some adults. And we know it's a left brain activity. Is everyone capable of doing, say, for instance, algebra?
Well, you know, as a psychologist that had at one point taught psychological and neuropsychological testing to our postdocs and interns, one of the jobs that we have is to test out people's the examinees' various cognitive skills, and one of the cognitive skills is computation and that sort of thing. And what we have found over the vast number of years when we test these skills is that people learn either to like something or dislike something. So there's a tremendous intimidation factor for mathematics. And unfortunately, some people grow to be fearful of it. So very few people are actually impaired with some kind of dyscalculia, it's technically called, because of some kind of neuronal deficit. But more people have poor skills in math because they have been so intimidated by the challenge of it, because it's, let's face it, it's a language, it's a number of very dry concepts, and you know, many people in graduate school, for example, have to take statistics and to get a master's or PhD or whatever, and there's a common joke among us that it's statistics, because people feel like it's torture, and the reality is it's not that intimidating once you grow to like it. So if you don't mind me telling you a little story about sitting down for the licensing exam for to be a psychologist. So in the mid-80s, I was a mental health administrator, and I thought, well, what the heck? I have a PhD. I might as well get a license so I can also have a private practice. And at that point, the license exam for a psychologist, national exam, had a 26% passage rate. That was a lot of people that were failing that exam. And
I'll say.
Yeah, and so I actually came from a fairly large university where they required that you had good research skills and everything else. But let's face it, I was pretty rusty in that area because I hadn't been exercising my statistical skills with research. And so I had to convince myself that I love statistics. And once you convince yourself that you like something, you're going to be far more motivated to learn it. So what I did was I carried around in a pad in my pocket little formulas for, let's say, the standard error of estimate and a number of other statistical equations. And I would just savor those formulas and look at them while I was moving my lettuce line to the grocery store and everything. And the point that I'm trying to raise is I had to convince myself I liked it. And in fact, it worked. It worked. I started studying it with much more hunger because I liked it. And so when, getting back to your question about parents that have kids that don't do well in math, well, part of them not doing well in math is that they don't like it. And helping them like it is a major part of the acquisition of that skill. And so very few people have brain disorders that make it difficult for them to acquire mathematical skills.
Would they have to actually have a brain injury to have difficulty with it?
Yeah, let me give you an example. So when I was doing neuropsychological testing, these are tests that neuropsychologists give to people that have various types of brain damage or were wondering about it. So I was giving those kinds of tests to various people in the late 80s. And that's when we had we didn't have very good imaging devices. The functional MRI and other instruments weren't readily available to us. So I gave two batteries of tests to two women with actual bullets in their brains. And the neurosurgeon didn't want to pull the bullets out of their brains because they do more tissue damage. And in fact, just as a sidebar, unfortunately, both of these women were the victims of domestic violence. So it was pretty clear to us that the bullets that were lodged in their brain were put there by their husbands. But typical of a brain injury, what you have is what is called post-traumatic amnesia. So you don't remember anything about the event, and the larger the span of time before and after really dictates or tells us the degree of brain damage. So neither women knew that their husbands were the ones that shot them, essentially. But going on with my story, so one of the women actually, prior to the injury, did tax returns for a living. So she worked for H&R Block or some company like that. And as you and I know quite well, you know, doing your tax returns requires arithmetic skills. You know, you have to really know how to count and multiply and divide and everything else. So she was really keen at math. But after the injury, she was very, very poor at math. And it turns out that the bullet that was lodged in her brain, still there, was lodged in the posterior left parietal temporal area. And that area seems to correspond to mathematical skills. And so here you have a person with great skills prior to the injury and very poor skills after the injury. And where was the bullet? In the area of the brain corresponding to that kind of injury. Now, let me say that if you are a child and you get that kind of injury in that particular area, you have a greater ability to acquire those skills in other areas of your brain. So there's a greater degree of neuroplasticity available the younger you are. Doesn't mean you can't, you know, grow new cells and make new connections and all that as we age, but you have more available flexibility early in your life.
Are you saying that that you could rewire the brain in other areas to pick up for that deficit?
Exactly. So let's say that you are blind at birth. And the areas of the cortex that are involved with vision are the areas we call the occipital lobes. And so your blindness now requires that you accentuate other skills to navigate around the room, let's say, or around your environment. And a person that is blind might develop better auditory skills and tactile skills, in other words, feeling things. And so those areas corresponding to auditory functions and also tactile functions in the parietal and the temporal lobes seem to, you could say, blend into the occipital lobe. So the occipital lobes now are used for auditory and tactile functions. So you could do that far more easily early in your life than later in your life. Another example is language acquisition. So you and I, probably a whole lot older than you are, but nevertheless, we're both over 9, right? And so if you learn a language prior to age 9, most probably you're going to learn it without an accent. If you learn a language, a second language or third language, after age 9, 12, and so on, you're going to learn that language with an accent. You follow what I mean? So in other words, you have a little bit more available to work with to develop these skills. But we, as we move through our life, acquire all sorts of capacities and skills and everything else that are hard to unlearn, like the way we use our R's, for example. If you're, you know, trying to, if you're a Japanese person, you know, you might have a little difficulty with the R intonation or whatever. So, yeah, earlier a little bit better for plasticity, but that doesn't necessarily mean that somebody late in their life can't develop new skills. We know that that is very much the case, that people in their 80s and 90s that are pushing their brains to acquire new skills are challenging their brain to make new connections. I use my father as a great example. Can I go on and describe what he has done?
Absolutely.
So after he received his law degree in the late 40s in Boston, he kept going to college. And, in fact, he was in college, in graduate school, when he died in 2006. Every single semester of his life after law school, he was studying a whole variety of subjects like historical geology and oceanography. When he died, he was a graduate student in painting. So
amazing.
He was constantly challenging his brain and challenging his brain in areas that he knew nothing about. So he thought, well, geez, I don't know anything about oceanography. I'll take an oceanography class. Oftentimes he would try to grasp what he didn't understand in areas that he was somewhat familiar with. So let's take deep, for example. He loved the Impressionist painters, specifically Renoir. And so he would go to Paris every year for a month. You know, retired judges have a good pension, so he could go there for a month. And, of course, he would go to the Orsay you know, that's where the Impressionist paintings are in great abundance. But he would also go to the Picasso Museum in Paris. And I went to the Picasso Museum there with him a couple times. And each time I would say afterwards, well, Dad, I don't quite understand. Why do you like to go to the Picasso Museum? I don't. I thought you didn't like Picasso. He said, I don't. And I said, well, geez, well, why is it that you go there? And he says, well, because it's interesting. So if you have ever been there, it's very much like a lot of museums devoted to one artist. It's pretty much chronological. You know, if you go to the O'Keeffe Museum in Santa Fe or the Van Gogh in Amsterdam or whatever, you start out in his early periods and you go chronologically. And so he would stand there and look at Picasso's blue period. And, you know, during the Picasso blue period, he looked almost like an Impressionist painter. You know, you could see what he was painting. There were sort of pastel-y colors, and in this case, he really liked the color blue. But then Picasso started hanging around with Braque, you know, this guy that with him that started breaking things up. It was called Cubism in the teens, roughly 100 years ago right now. And he stood there and scratched his head, and he said, what the heck was he doing? He was a good painter. I don't understand this. And but he would go there and keep on forcing himself to try to understand what he didn't quite understand. Now, why am I going on with this story? Well, that's where you build new connections in the brain. When you try to grasp what you don't like, when you don't quite understand, that's where you build more infrastructure. If you do what you always like, all you're going to do is strengthen those pathways that support that particular subject. So learning a language in a whole different language family. Let's say, for example, you know, we're speaking in the Germanic language. English is a Germanic language, and let's say we try to learn Russian, you know, which is in the Slavic Indo-European group. Well, that's a little harder than learning German, let's say, because again, you're jumping into a whole new area. Or let's say learning Chinese, Mandarin. Well, that's even more difficult. And learning how to write in Chinese, you know, with the characters and all that, that's tremendously challenging for us, and more brain building takes place.
Interesting.
So we could say go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I just want to let the listeners know, in case they're just tuning in right now, that we're talking with John Arden. He's the author of the book, The Brain Bible. So, John, I have another question for you. We're seeing that a lot of people are being diagnosed with cancer, and they a lot of times they undergo chemotherapy. Have you found in your research that chemotherapy can cross the blood-brain barrier and affect the left side of the brain for mathematics?
Well, first of all, let me say that I am not an expert in chemotherapy, but I know some general things about it.
Mm-hmm.
So the so-called chemo brain, that is kind of a
broad
term that people talk about. I don't know it's necessarily specific to target the left. I think it's more general, so that with chemotherapy, you'd find more global chemo effects, which include, by the way, the reduction in neurogenesis. Well, that would make a whole lot of sense, wouldn't it? I mean, what you're trying to do is reduce cancer cells. And what happens when you increase neurogenesis is you're also increasing cancer cells too. So blocking cell growth is one of the unfortunate side effects, you could say, of chemotherapy, because you're also blocking other kinds of cell growth, and including not only tumor cell growth. So what you find is with chemo brain, let's say, is sort of this cognitive fog that people unfortunately go through, whereby it's harder to kind of think clearly and harder to be sharp remember things. And so there's more of a global effect than a specific mathematical effect. So since you picked out math, for example, math isn't necessarily a discrete skill, but rather, let's say that if I were to give you a word arithmetic word problem, you have to really listen to what I'm saying, hold it in your what is called working memory, memory is holding the information in mind while you listen to more information than I'm giving to you, and then you manipulate the information to come up with some kind of arithmetic solution. So it's not just math alone, but rather it's the ability of your prefrontal cortex, that's the kind of the commander of the brain, to pay attention, to hold things in your mind in working memory. And what we find with people with chemotherapy, it's a little bit more difficult to kind of stay present, because again, there's more of a global effect that's occurring.
Okay, interesting. Let's get back to your book, The Brain Bible, and let's continue on with the rest of seed. I think we'll be going into diet, talking about diet and how it affects the brain.
Okay, and diet is probably one of the most, that and exercise, probably the two most important deficits that we as Americans are now experiencing. Since roughly 1980, the obesity levels have shot up dramatically. For two reasons, largely. One is the lack of exercise, and the other one is we've been eating a lot of junk. We've been eating a lot of processed foods, simple carbohydrates, and also trans fatty acids. So let's go through some of these factors. So with simple carbohydrates, these are foods that have been processed already. So by the time you consume a simple carbohydrate, part of it has already been process for you, so when you do eat it, it turns into glucose so much more quickly. And you don't want that to happen, because you're going to get more oxidative damage. In other words, more free radical damage, and that means you're going to get what is called excitotoxicity. In other words, cells are going to kind of burn out and die more easily. And also, you're going to produce what is called advanced glycation end products. And that sounds like a kind of a technical term, but let me unbundle it a little bit. What happens there when you eat simple carbohydrates is you make your cell structures rigid and stiff. So if you can think in terms of how meat gets cross-linked when you're, let's say, barbecuing some chicken, and you forget to turn it over, and it gets a little too tough, and you're now chewing it, and it's, oh, geez, should I eat this? I don't know. It's not black. I'm not going to give you the tough piece. I'll give you the tender piece. But you go ahead and eat the dry piece, and it's hard to chew, hard to digest, and everything else.
Sure.
Well, when you eat simple carbohydrates, your cell structures get stiff and rigid, and harking back to our earlier discussion about neuroplasticity, your brain requires soft and pliable cells to create new synaptic connections. So if you have stiff and rigid cells, it's hard to make these new connections because they're stiff and rigid. So you're rendering your brain disabled in terms of learning. So people eating a whole lot of simple carbohydrates, especially older folks, boy, it's harder to digest in general. Or for any person experiencing a chronic illness like cancer, it's harder to do normal body functions. So your body's already compromised because it's fighting off. It's trying to marshal this immune system to battle these chronic illnesses. And now you're eating bad stuff, so to speak, to put it really in general terms, like simple carbohydrates. Now what you're doing is you're making your body work harder to get nutrients, and you're creating the process through which your body is creating excitotoxicity and burning out and dying, killing cells. Now, let's move on to trans fatty acids, if we will. Well, trans fatty acids are formed as a result of heating up vegetable oil in metal containers. So, you know, when you fry something in a metal container, you're creating the process of acquiring trans fatty acids. And when you consume trans fatty acids, what's happening is you're making your brain now acquire a gooey, sluggy gunk in your brain. It plugs up essentially your arteries and your capillaries. So if we were to erase somehow with Photoshop all cells in your brain except for just the blood vessels, you know, your arteries, your capillaries and everything, you'd still see a huge mass there because there's little blood vessels everywhere. So your brain requires good circulation. And later in life, you don't want to have bad circulation in your brain because you can get all sorts of injuries. In other words, more subtle injuries than a big stroke, you know, the blocking of artery and all that. All these little capillaries that feed your cells require good circulation. So with trans fatty acids, you're plugging up the system, and you're making your brain acquire a substance very much like you're acquiring when you eat saturated fat. In other words, people that eat a lot of red meat, non-lean red meat, for example, tend to create the plumbing problem that I'm talking about in general with trans fatty acids. So you could say that people that eat a lot of saturated fat, meaning a lot of hamburger, let's say, and a lot of fried foods, tend to have cardiovascular problems and get dementia earlier than people that don't. So those two factors, you could say cut out the simple carbohydrates out of your diet and cut out the trans fatty acids and saturated fat. You'll do a whole lot better.
Yeah, I mean, sugar is very destructive, and it's in almost every single food item that you purchase at the grocery store.
Exactly.
If it's not a whole food.
Yeah, exactly. Even ketchup. And in fact, there's a oncologist at San Francisco, University of California, San Francisco, that has sort of made a name for himself in a good way by talking about how the high consumption of sugar is a major concern for people who have developed cancer. You really want to stay away from sugar items. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you want to stay away from cancer, good idea to stay away from sugar. I'm not saying sugar causes cancer. He thinks so. But, you know, I'm not in the know to the degree that he is. But it certainly doesn't help. and it really collapses your immune system as well. And that could lead us to the last letter of seeds, which is sleep. And so let's say you eat a lot of simple carbohydrates, and you eat a lot of simple carbohydrates at dinner. So you've got a higher level of glucose, and glucose is sort of like sugar in your brain. I don't mean sugar in the granulated sense, but your brain kind of runs on glucose. And you don't want to have an elevated surge in glucose because what's going to happen is now you're going to create all this oxidative damage, and you're also going to kind of go up quick and then crash afterwards. And the crash is one in which you're going to feel more anxious and uneasy, and if you have any kind of pain at all, you're going to have more pain. Well, that's a bad thing to do at night when you're trying to go to sleep. Or let's say you eat big spaghetti dinner, but it's white flour. Well, you know, a lot of that spaghetti dinner is junk because it's just a bunch of white flour. It turns into glucose too quickly, and then in the middle of your sleep cycle, you're going to have more shallow sleep. So what do I mean by shallow sleep? Well, there's a sleep architecture, and so there are stages of sleep, and we need to get good quality sleep architecture. So in other words, the slow wave sleep is probably the most important stage of sleep for the recuperation of the body, boosting the immune system, developing better consolidation of what we call in psychology explicit memory. And so a lot of very, very important processes, both general physiological and cognitive, occur in slow-wave sleep. And so if you disturb slow-wave sleep by acquiring, let's say, simple carbohydrates in your diet or taking a glass of wine at night. Now, where do I live? I live in the wine country of Sonoma County. And so I see a lot of people that come in to see me and say, well, you know, I've got this problem. I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can't get back to sleep until 3:30. Well, the next thing out of my mouth, almost like a reflex, is, were you drinking anything at night? And they said, yeah, I'm drinking a glass or two of wine at night. So I explain the process through which alcohol is metabolized, and it turns out that if you don't mind me getting a little technical here, if you drink alcohol, you're dampening down one of the principal activating neurotransmitters in the brain called glutamate, and stimulating, and I call it sort of counterfeit GABA. And GABA is the principal inhibiting neurotransmitter in the brain. So when you have a glass of wine, you go, I feel so much more relaxed. And so it's like you get a burst of GABA and your glutamate level is dampened down. But 3 to 4 hours later, your brain thinks it's got enough GABA and the blockade or the dampening down of the glutamate is taken off. So now in the middle of your sleep cycle, you get this burst of glutamate with not enough GABA. So you get all agitated and you don't have any resources to calm yourself down, and you don't want to be like that at 2 and 3 in the morning. You want to be relaxed. And so, of course, people in my area say, but John, it's good wine. And I say, well, I don't care if it's a $300 Cabernet. It doesn't make any difference to your brain. Your brain thinks it's alcohol, and that's what happens with alcohol. So anyway,
oh my gosh.
So what you got to do is avoid sleep depressors, and alcohol mm-hmm. is one of them. Certainly caffeine. Afternoon mm-hmm. is also another one. Mm-hmm. Lack of exercise is another one. And mm-hmm. also keeping your bedroom too warm. You want to be cool. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I know that many people live in areas like the American Southwest and Arizona and southern New Mexico and all that, and it gets pretty warm at night in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever
mm-hmm.
you can do to keep your bedroom cool mm-hmm. at night, it's going to be a whole lot better for you, because we know that people during the wintertime seem to sleep better because
True.
The bedrooms are generally cooler as long as they
mm-hmm.
don't have that forced air heat mm-hmm. on and off and on and off. So keeping your body temperature down is really important. And can I add one more, just then we can round the sleep
mm-hmm.
factor out.
Mm-hmm.
One of the appliances, you could say, that's used in contemporary culture is a computer. And many people
mm-hmm.
are on their computers late at night. And what
yes.
they're doing is they're essentially looking at a computer screen. And so your retina is actually part of your brain, is picking up light, and it signals your brain that it's daytime outside. So eventually that information gets to your pineal gland that's positioned right in the middle of your brain that secretes, when it's dark, melatonin. That's the hormone that regulates the circadian rhythm. It in a sense, tells your brain it's daytime outside. It's not time to go to sleep. So looking at computer screens late at night actually create insomnia. So it's a good idea to have low light late at night. So, you know, if you want to do your emails and everything else, do them earlier, much better for you.
How many hours before bedtime?
The more the better. So you might want to say, well, geez, go into your more low light mode about 3 hours. Most people can't do that. About 3 hours before, keep the lights low. And then a lot of people
mm-hmm.
say, well, what about reading? Well, reading's good. You just don't want to have real bright light and shiny pages that are going to reflect
mm-hmm.
a whole lot of light. So keep the light low. And another thing you want to do is make sure your bedroom is a conducer for sleep, and that's it, or sleep and sex, and that's
mm-hmm.
it. No TV in there. It's not an entertainment zone. It's not a place to argue with your partner about your finances. It's for those two.
Right. Well, we only have a few minutes left. I just wanted to do a recap. We've talked about education, diet, exercise. Obviously, we just kind of pulled in relationships and sleep. The last thing that you talk about in your book is moderating your stress. So you want to add something to that?
Right. Now, stress in itself isn't bad because when people say to me, well, geez, Dr. Arden, I want to get a stress-free life, and I say, I don't actually say this, but I want to say this. Well, what, do you want to be dead or something? Stress is a part of life. It's how much stress and how long. That's really the question. So a little stress, in fact, the word stress is now being, by neuroscientists, sort of discarded because it really doesn't describe much. Rather, the term that's being embraced is allostasis, meaning do you have enough resources to get through the challenges of the day, like shock absorbers on the road? And so you don't want chronic stress, extreme stress. And what happens when you have those, chronic or extreme stress, is you get what is called allostatic load. In other words, you don't have enough resources to deal with the demands. And so if you do have chronic stress, let's just call it that, because people know what that is, meaning you're just constantly tapped out, you can't rest, you have no downtime at all, now you're creating the neurophysiology that's actually destructive to your brain. Your cortisol level, that's a stress hormone, goes way up, And we know that people that have had chronic stress that have been in major catastrophes, like my relatives were in a big genocide. I'm an Armenian, so you know many of them were massacred by the Turks, and you know of course they had high levels of cortisol trying to get away, and you know many of them didn't. So high levels of cortisol over a period of time, we know this from Holocaust victims as well, or 9/11 people down in Lower Manhattan and so on. High levels of cortisol damaging to the brain, and specifically the hippocampus, the area of the brain corresponding to memory. So if you are experiencing stress, you want to be very, very scrupulous about practicing the seeds elements, because those five factors that we went through before are the brain-friendly factors. So if you don't do these five factors, your stress, or let's say even your trauma, might result later into more of a trauma disorder like PTSD, because you know only 11-18% of people that experience a life-threatening trauma actually get PTSD. And so people like me, we're always trying to research, well, who is it and why did the people that experienced a life-threatening trauma developed a PTSD? Well, they didn't practice the seeds elements. That's one factor. And I shouldn't say one factor, it's more five factors. So practicing all five of those is you could say, stress reliever. You've got to get good quality sleep because your stress hormones are going to be up the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you have a trauma, you've got chronic stress and everything else, and you get bad quality sleep. Now you're going to have more stress the next day, or you eat a lot of simple carbohydrates, you drink alcohol, you have no social connections.
Trying to feel better.
Yeah. And so you think that what you need to do is go withdraw and isolate yourself. Actually, that makes things worse.
Mm-hmm.
So practicing these seeds elements are imperative to help you deal with those stressful situations that many people in regular life experience, even driving on those Southern California freeways that I know that in your neighborhood can be stressful. And so by the time you get to work, maybe an hour and a half later, you're kind of keyed up. Taking a good walk and making sure you got good nutrition, good social connectiveness, making sure that the next night you get a good night's sleep, all those factors are really going to be important.
Well, John Arden, before we close today, why don't you tell our listeners where they can purchase your book, The Brain Bible, and give them your website?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My website is www.drjohnarden.com, with no gaps between the doctor and the – it's just Dr. John Arden, all one word, .com. And the Brain Bible can be purchased at Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com, or if you go to my website, you can get any one of those links, and including Powell's Books, which is probably the best bookstore on the West Coast. Four city blocks in the city of Portland, Oregon, and they have an online resource as well.
Wonderful. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, having you on my show today. And you've imparted some really valuable information for our listeners. And
well,
I can't thank you,
so thank you
enough.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you today, and look forward to hearing your show in the future.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so
much.
All right, listeners,
please tune in again next Wednesday. We will have another great show for you. And have a wonderful evening.
We celebrate our listeners worldwide and invite you to contact Denise at www.healthmedianow.com with any questions you may have, and follow her on Twitter at Health Media Now and Facebook at Health Media Now. For those interested in an advertising campaign on her show, contact Lisa at knowledgeworkspub.com. Be sure to visit gotcancernowwhat.com for information on Denise Messenger's award-winning book, Got cancer? Now what?
Listeners, I just wanted to remind you that this show is based upon the opinions of Denise and her guest. It's not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional of your choice, and it's not intended as medical advice. We're sharing knowledge and information and the experience of Denise and her community. We encourage you to make your own healthcare decisions based upon your research and in partnership with a qualified healthcare professional of your choice. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. Thank you. Bye-bye for now.